Around the World with Reporters.
After a still deeply disputed election, new United States President Joe Biden has reached 100 days in office with a lower approval rating than any other newly elected president since 1953, excepting Donald Trump. Many believe the country is only in a temporary political calm, which could be broken with the reported return of Trump to the political rally circuit in May.
Well, I don't know if the honeymoon is over. I think in some cases the honeymoon was over a few days after the inauguration, or even before the inauguration.
Biden finally gave his address, where he also unveiled a 10-year social infrastructure plan, which is expected to get many months of pushback from Congress. Many say Biden has had some successes: the coronavirus vaccine distribution, the $2 trillion infrastructure plan, ending the Muslim travel ban, and returning to the Paris Climate Agreement. But Biden has already backtracked from campaign promises in many vital areas. The fight for $15 per hour, the amount and length of unemployment payments, total household stimulus payments, dropping Medicare eligibility to 60 years old, student debt relief, reversing Trump's tax cuts for the rich, and more.
He's reneged on everything he promised, and he comes up with an excuse. I can't do it, or we can't do it because one guy's voting against it. We can't do it because the parliamentarian has decided we can't put it in the bill. I mean, people are pretty much aware that these are lame excuses, and that the Democrats, and Biden especially, are just using these lame excuses to not do what they said they would do.
At 100 days and amid similar economic disaster, Franklin Delano Roosevelt had passed 15 major bills which established hugely influential initiatives. Contrarily, Biden's $1.9 trillion economic stimulus package didn't establish a single long-term program. On foreign policy, Biden has adopted almost all of the stances of his controversial predecessor. He has not lifted sanctions on Iran nor returned to the JCPOA pact on Iran's nuclear energy program. Russia's foreign minister said Biden's refusal of diplomacy and lack of respect could make relations worse than even during the Cold War. He has not taken Cuba off the state terrorist list, and he adopted Trump's widely criticized low quota for asylum seekers despite a crisis on the southern border. Ramin Mazahari, Chicago.
The COVID-19 pandemic has led to a sharp rise in racism against Asians, hate crimes against Chinese, East, and Southeast Asians, and the horrific Atlanta shootings in the U.S. threw the topic into stark relief. In Britain, too, violence against Asians has become a bigger problem than it already was. According to one statistic, hate crimes against Asians in Britain increased fourfold in the first quarter of last year, a trend that continues to this day.
I was in my eye test appointment, and there was two spaces between me, and every single people that came didn't choose to sit next to me.
I feel unsafe when I'm by myself, so I just like listen to the music. But you know, some people are still gonna say something when they see Asian people.
Before there were any lockdowns, the Chinese and other ethnic communities had already been suffering abuse as a result of fear and misunderstanding stoked by internet conspiracies. Then came former U.S. President Donald Trump pointing the finger of blame for the pandemic at China.
Many of the victims have started telling their stories on social media, where they're receiving increasing attention. Among them, a growing number of Asian healthcare workers, such as this nurse, racially abused by a patient whose very life he was helping save.
Racism does exist in our society. It's mirrored colonialism. Britain has been the largest colonial power, arguably, for the last 200 to 300 years, and an ideology that particularly came with the Victorians has risen to reflect that, one of European supremacy, and particularly British supremacy and white supremacy.
The thought of the UK being unsafe is a sentiment shared by British Asian healthcare workers. Some have thought of moving elsewhere, but have had to stay because of the pandemic-imposed restrictions on travel and immigration.
a disproportional number of them drawn, especially from overseas, who trained overseas, find themselves in subordinate positions within the NHS. So despite their skill, despite their education, they're less likely to be in substantive consultant positions. They're more likely to be at staff grade, at sub-consultant level, career grade, to find it hard to progress. So there's like a glass ceiling.
The easing or lifting of lockdown measures should ordinarily come as exciting news for many. But for the Asian community in Britain, among them frontline healthcare professionals, the bitter experiences of the past year will continue to impact their lives for years to come. Saeed Puriza, London.
The socioeconomic malaise that has been worsened by the COVID crisis is erupting at an unprecedented level everywhere in Italy. Many hundreds large and small-scale protests have been held across the country over the past months. On Wednesday, thousands of street vendors staged a protest against a city decision to stop the extension of their licenses. They blocked the capital's Ring Road and occupied the central Republic Square as tens of thousands of itinerant street trading businesses are at risk of closure due to an EU directive on free trade.
Italy has been under attack since the EU introduced the Bolkestein Directive, which aims at establishing a single market for services. Our Parliament has already opposed the adoption of this provision.
We have been abandoned in these testing times. How dare they? The mayor wants to impose standards in Rome. She's killing us.
Also on Wednesday, pilots, flight attendants and other airline industry workers gathered in central Rome to stage a protest against a rescue plan to save the bankrupt former national airline Alitalia. The airline is running out of cash for fuel and salaries, and workers fear some 7,000 employees will be sacked if a buyout offer by a group of investors gets the green light from the government.
The government is not listening to our demands. We have not even been paid last month. That's how Alitalia special commissioners are treating us.
The Draghi government is not used to listening to workers' needs. I am afraid this executive can only make unpopular decisions.
Recently, Italy's parliament has overwhelmingly approved the government's European Union-funded pandemic recovery plan worth 248 billion euros. Prime Minister Draghi has pledged the plan would address both the damage caused by COVID and the country's long-standing structural issues.
Italy is at a crossroads. There is the risk that the pandemic may turn into an unprecedented socio-economic crisis that will drag on for a very long time. But Italians also have the opportunity to use the funds from a vigorous stimulus package of the EU to relaunch employment and growth. It remains to be seen whether the country will succeed in this process. Max Civili, Rome.
As the world marks World Immunization Week 2021, people in Gaza don't have enough vaccines because of Israeli restrictions. World Immunization Week, celebrated every year in the last week of April, aims to promote the use of vaccines to protect people of all ages against disease. The Gaza Strip has only received enough vaccines for about 50,000 people. More vaccines are desperately needed as the current volume of doses is not enough for the more than 2 million people living in Gaza. Despite the increasing number of COVID-19 infections in the Gaza Strip, the Israeli regime continues to place tight restrictions on the entry of medical supplies, including vaccines.
Under international law, Israel as an occupying power must adopt and apply the prophylactic and preventive measures necessary to combat the spread of contagious diseases and epidemics in areas under its occupation. Israel must supply the people of the Gaza Strip with all necessary means to combat the coronavirus, including vaccines.
The surge in infections and deaths is threatening to overwhelm hospitals weakened by years of Israeli blockade. Currently, there are some 15,000 active coronavirus cases in the Gaza Strip.
The health situation is very dangerous, and hospitals are going through very tough times. Every day we lose loved ones because of this deadly pandemic. We need all the necessary help to fight this wave of infections.
The weakness of the healthcare system makes Gaza's population highly vulnerable to further major outbreaks of the deadly pandemic. The enclave's health sector has been battered by the Israeli blockade and multiple wars.
The Israeli blockade since 2007 has taken its toll on Gaza's health sector and left it in a very bad shape. The health sector is fragile and suffers from acute shortages in medicines and hospital supplies to deal with deadly pandemic. Hospitals and medical centers also need more trained medical personnel to deal with the surge of infections.
The Gaza Strip is currently witnessing the worst wave of the COVID-19 pandemic.
Rights groups say Israel's illegal practices have compounded the risk of coronavirus infection for nearly 2 million Palestinians living in the besieged coastal strip. The measures, they say, are making it extremely difficult to combat the deadly pandemic. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
A month of campaigning for an official British definition of Islamophobia has climaxed with a flash mob protest staged by activist Maz Salim, who lit up government buildings with the image of her father, Mohammed Salim, who was murdered by a racist terrorist in 2013.
I'm here outside UK Parliament to force this government, the media and the police to recognise my father's death as an act of terrorism, as well as the three mosque bombings in the West Midlands. It's been actually quite horrendous. Over the last 8 years, my father's death has been ignored on the mainstream media. Whenever they talk about acts of terrorism in the UK or on UK soil, my father's act of terrorism, and not only my father's death, the three mosque bombings that followed, have always been missed off the list, even though Pablo Lapshin was charged under terrorism laws. So my anger at the media and the politicians is, and the police as well, is intense.
Despite appeals from the family, British media refuses to prescribe the murder as a terrorist incident, which Ms. Salim believes comes from institutional Islamophobia.
When it's a Muslim who is the perpetrator, they get global media attention, back-to-back news headlines. But when the Muslim is the victim, we don't get the same media coverage.
Anti-Muslim hate crimes have been on the increase under the current government's watch, with complaints met with silence.
When Prime Minister Boris Johnson referred to Muslim women as bank robbers and letterboxes in 2019, Islamophobic incidences surged, with a 375% spike recorded at the time. Now, with such high-level leadership engaging in anti-Muslim prejudice, can we expect to see meaningful change despite the tireless effort from these anti-racism campaigners? That has yet to be seen. Robert Carter, London.
Amid the continued advancement of the Yemeni army in the city of Marib, the Saudi-led coalition has begun to build new military camps in Shabwa and Al-Wadi'a areas to deploy more troops in the city.
What the Saudi-led coalition has in mind by building new military camps in Shabwa and Al-Wadi'a areas shows that the coalition is losing the control of Marib. It is now desperately trying to keep the city under its control, but the Yemeni army is determined to liberate all Yemeni lands.
The latest measures by Saudi-led coalition in Marib comes after Yemeni army backed by allied fighters from popular committees took control of strategic areas, including Tum al-Ulya Hill, which is 4 kilometers away from the western neighborhoods of the city of Marib.
Al-Tuma al-Ulya Hill has a great military and strategic importance as it can provide Yemeni army with a good opportunity to achieve its military goals. The hill overlooks the city of Marib, so the Yemeni army will be able to target the enemy inside the city.
The Yemeni army has also intensified its retaliatory attacks against Saudi Arabia. Earlier, Yemeni troops launched an attack with a drone of Qasif K2 against King Khalid Airbase in Asir in retaliation for the ongoing Saudi war and siege.
Yemenis say their army will continue its operations to liberate all the Yemeni lands, including the oil-rich province of Marib, the last stronghold of Saudi Arabia in northern Yemen. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
Turkey vowed to respond duly to U.S. President Joe Biden's recognition of the events of 1915 as a genocide. Back on Saturday, Joe Biden said The U.S. honors the victims of the Metz-Jagern so that the horrors of what happened were never lost to history. He became the first U.S. president to officially recognize the alleged Armenian genocide. Immediately after Biden's declaration, Turkey's foreign ministry denounced him in strongest terms, saying the move does not have a scholarly and legal basis, nor is it supported by any evidence. The ministry also summoned the U.S. ambassador to Ankara to voice its protest against Washington. Meanwhile, Turkish defense minister said that the declaration by the U.S. president may disrupt peace in the region.
Historical events should not be used as a tool of conflict and setting an account. They should not be politicized. It is clear that such an environment will negatively affect ties between Turkey and Armenia, Turks and Armenians, as well as regional peace. It should be known that history cannot be rewritten through such political statements.
Relations between Turkey and U.S. have been in trouble, especially after U.S. imposed sanctions on Turkey for purchasing Russian-made S-400 missiles. Ankara is also still angry at Washington for supporting and aiding Kurdish militants in Syria, which Turkey considers as terrorists. This statement is seen by many as an addition to the pile of tensions between the two NATO allies.
I think the declaration by the U.S. President Biden will create further tensions between Ankara and Washington. The declaration is not legally binding. Turkey has always said it's ready to open its archive for evidence. However, the use of this card every now and then by Washington will create a strategic row between the two NATO allies.
Since Saturday, protests were held in front of the U.S. consulate in Istanbul, with demonstrators denouncing the statement and calling on Ankara to cut ties with Washington. Turkey often lodges a formal complaint when foreign governments describes the tragic wartime events in Ottoman Turkey as genocide. Ankara maintains that many people on both sides of the conflict lost their lives. It also proposed to the Armenian side on 2005 the establishment of a joint history commission to reach a just conclusion about the historical facts of that period. Rashan Saglam, Istanbul.
Given the prevailing poverty in Afghanistan, active charities and relief organizations in the country normally increase their support to the most vulnerable people, mainly widows, orphans, and jobless people during the holy month of Ramadan. Imam Khomeini Relief Committee is one of the most active charity organizations in Afghanistan that has provided many services to Afghans, especially to poor families, since its establishment in Afghanistan at least two decades ago. Representatives of the Relief Committee of Imam Khomeini and Iranian Embassy in Kabul attended this iftari program at one of Kabul's orphanages as a show of support and respect to the culture of helping poor ones.
We view all Muslim countries, particularly Afghanistan, as our brothers. We look to them as our own people. Iran and Afghanistan enjoy too much commonalities in terms of cultural, religion, society, and many other fields. That is why we proudly do whatever in our power to help them.
The participation of the delegation of Iranian embassy in Kabul in events like this is usually welcomed by Afghans.
Iran is our neighbor and an Islamic country. We consider it as a brother nation who has always supported us in different fields such as culture, economy, politics, and social affairs, especially since the war began in Afghanistan.
As observers say, Iran is one of greatest supporters of Afghanistan that has extensively backed the people and governments of Afghanistan since decades ago. Currently, Tehran plays a key role in Afghanistan and is supporting Kabul's policies, especially in terms of bringing peace to the war-ravaged country. Sayed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
The EU's controversial border and coast guard agency Frontex is on course to receive greater power to deport up to 500,000 refugees who have had their applications for asylum in the EU rejected. Frontex is under investigation over allegations that it has aggressively pushed back refugees trying to reach the 27-country bloc.
The European agency always have to comply with fundamental rights. And I don't think that is right to accuse that Frontex is not doing that. And if there are shortcomings in Frontex, they have to be addressed.
The European Commission has just launched its so-called voluntary return and reintegration strategy. The European Trade Union Confederation and several rights groups say it's all about border control, deterrence, detention and deportation of refugees.
Let's have a common asylum policy between EU member states, put it into practice, and then we see where we are. Certainly, this is not going to stop.
Just last week, 130 refugees drowned after their dinghy capsized in the Mediterranean as they attempted to reach the EU. Frontex vessels didn't get to the scene on time. The situation is not good for those who do make it to the block. More than 20,000 refugees are currently trapped on Greek and Spanish islands. Those include children, pregnant women, and people with mental health problems. They are surviving in trailers and tents and have limited access to essential services, including water. EU countries have made it clear they don't want to house refugees. Denmark is pushing ahead with plans to deport Syrians back to their war-torn country. Rights groups say this is astonishing given the role the West played in practically destroying the Arab Republic. Aid agencies say the EU is paying billions of euro to Turkey and African countries to prevent refugees from trying to seek asylum here. This as the EU is being forced to defend the actions of its own agencies.
We will not accept this Frontex bashing that comes so cheap.
Rights groups say the EU continues to breach the 1951 UN Refugee Convention, which obliges the bloc to protect asylum seekers. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio.
On Sundays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. In the name of Allah, from whom I hope for nothing but bounty, and from whom I fear nothing but justice. I rely only upon His word, and I cling only to His cord. In Thee I seek sanctuary, O possessor of pardon and good pleasure, from wrong and enmity, and from the changes of time, and the recurrence of sorrows, and from the striking of mishaps, and from the expiration of my term before preparation and readiness. From Thee I seek guidance to that wherein is righteousness and being set right. From Thee I seek help in that which is linked to success and favorable response. Thee I beseech for the garment of well-being and its completion, and for the covering of health and its permanence. I seek refuge in Thee, my Lord, from the goadings of the Satans. And I seek protection in Thy sovereignty from the injustice of the sovereigns. So accept my past prayers and fasting, and make my tomorrow and what is after better than my present hour and my today. And exalt me in my clan and my people, and protect me in my waking and my sleeping. For Thou art Allah, the best guardian, and Thou art the most merciful of the merciful. O Allah, I am quit before Thee on this day of mine and on all Sundays that follow it, of associating others with Thee and of heresy. And I devote my supplication sincerely to Thee, addressing myself to Thy response. And I observe the acts of obedience to You for the hope of Your rewards. So bless Muhammad, the best of thy creation, the summoner to thy truth. Exalt me with thy exaltation, which is never made to suffer loss. And protect me with thy eye, which never sleeps. And seal my affair by cutting me off from everything but thee and my life with forgiveness. Surely thou art the all-forgiving, the all-compassionate.
The debate.
In his first speech to Congress, U.S. President Joe Biden said, "We're in a competition with China and other countries to win the 21st century." The U.S. president said he's not seeking to worsen relations with Beijing and called diplomacy the best way to deal with disputes, but also said the U.S. will maintain a strong military presence in the Indo-Pacific. Beijing, for its part, has urged the U.S. to stop an upward trend in its military activities in the air and seas near China, which threatens regional peace. Joe Biden also said his country would stand up to China's unfair trade practices, accusing Beijing of intellectual property theft. Biden has maintained a tough anti-Beijing stance inherited from the previous administration, which also includes more visible support for Taiwan. This has infuriated China, which deems the island as part of its territory. The two countries are also locked in a years-long trade war. Well, joining us on tonight's debate, we have Director of Foreign Policy and Focus at the Institute for Policy Studies, Mr. John Pfeffer, who's joining us from Washington, D.C. Also, we have National Security Analyst Brian Downing joining us from Florida. Gentlemen, welcome to the program. Let's start off with Mr. Pfeffer in Washington, D.C. On Wednesday, Joe Biden said that the U.S. was in a competition with China and other countries to win the 21st century. Please unpack that for us.
Well, the United States has for, well, a couple of decades identified China as kind of the leading challenger to its international global power in the world. And this has proven to be a kind of focal point for U.S. economic and strategic thinking. In other words, the United States is currently kind of reorienting its military away from the war on terror, the endless wars in the Middle East and Afghanistan, and toward great power competition, China being perhaps the most important of those competitors. But it's also economic, of course, as China has become, according to several standards, the most powerful economy in the world. And so this is something that the Biden administration, as you pointed out, has to a certain extent inherited from the Trump administration, but also from the Obama administration as well.
Mr. Downing, in Florida, Biden said that he doesn't want a conflict with the world's second largest economy, but the U.S. will stand up for its fundamental trade rights. China has frequently maintained that a U.S. military presence in the South China Sea, the South China Sea, East China Sea, and Taiwan Strait is the main destabilizing factor in the region. Talk to us about the tensions under the new U.S. administration and who is threatening the stability of the region.
Well, you know, China is the rising economic power. It will be the most powerful economy in the world, and, you know, the estimates vary, but it's going to happen within 10 or 20 years. It's inevitable. And along with that growing sense of power, They want to show it symbolically, and historically one of the most important ways to do that has been through using your military, specifically your Navy, I think. You remember there was a time when the British Navy ranged from Europe through Caribbean, the Suez Canal, the Persian Gulf, Straits of Malacca, Hong Kong, everywhere. And then the United States, 100 years ago, Theodore Roosevelt sent the Great White Fleet around the world. It was a symbol that the United States was coming on and that Europe was a declining area. Well, China feels the same way towards the United States and wants to show it symbolically. I don't really think there's that much threat of an overt war between American and Chinese forces or even a major conflict. Remember, throughout the Cold War with the Soviet Union, we always heard, well, these incidents can get out of hand, and indeed they can. But through all that period, 1945 to 1991, things were pretty much held in check. There were hotlines, there were incidents. American and Russian naval vessels collided in the Mediterranean and elsewhere. So I really think it's a manageable thing. China, to my way of thinking, wants to dominate the world economically, establish its centricity in the world. Dominate might be too strong a word. Remember that in all recorded history, the Chinese economy has been the most powerful one in the world, except for two centuries, the 19th century and the 20th century. So to China, the West, the United States, these are historical aberrations that can and will be corrected in the next few decades. So I see it mostly as an economic conflict and not a military one. But as I said, incidents can happen.
Mr. Pfeffer, the Chinese Defense Ministry urged the United States on Thursday to rein in its frontline forces, which Beijing has said to have become more active in the air and seas near China this year. Why the increase in activity? What is the U.S. worried about?
Well, that's an interesting question. I mean, often at the beginning of administrations, whether we're talking about the Obama administration, the George W. Bush administration, there's heightened conflict with China initially as the two superpowers get a measure of one another. Often that has given way to a much more pragmatic relationship, to economic negotiations, even to some security negotiations. This time around, the Biden administration comes in at a time when it frankly has to focus on domestic issues. It has to revive the economy, has to get COVID under control. It is dealing with infrastructure needs. It has decided in large part to characterize those domestic transformations as equally necessary to combat rising China. In other words, we need infrastructure development in the United States to compete effectively with China. At the same time, we're responding to some of the initiatives under the Trump administration to draw together alliances more closely to contain China. This is kind of the flip side of Biden's approach to multilateralism. I mean, there are two approaches, obviously. One is to work with other countries to deal with global problems. The second is to work with your allies and some other countries to contain your adversaries. And it's this second type of multilateralism that the Biden administration has continued from the Trump years, for instance, coordinating with the so-called Quad, the United States, Japan, Australia, India, to discuss ways of combating Chinese influence, working more closely with Japan and South Korea in a greater trilateral cooperation, drawing closer with some of our allies around the South China Sea, particularly Vietnam in this case, military allies suddenly after 20 or 30 years of adversarial relations, all of it designed to push back at China and push back at what is perceived as greater assertiveness from the Chinese government, greater nationalism from the Chinese government. And so I think all of this combines to contribute to the United States giving signs through various methods, military methods, that it is not going to be falling back in the Pacific, that it will continue to assert itself as a Pacific power.
Mr. Downing, responding to a question about Biden's speech, a spokesman for China's foreign ministry said the U.S. was merely feeling insecure and jealous about China's development. Those comments were made by Wang Wenbin. He said at a daily briefing that this is in nature out of Cold War thinking, a zero-sum mindset, an ideological bias, and a sign of lack of confidence. Do you see it in that light as well?
I think there is, over the last few years, a sense of insecurity and resentment in the United States. That's something that just about every American knew for the last 75 years or so, that the United States was the dominant power in the world, is very much in doubt. And there are insecurities, resentments, and anxieties associated with that. But, you know, let's bear in mind that Chinese airplanes go fly over Taiwan airspace every day. They may be doing it right now while we're doing this interview. Their ships violate territorial waters of the Philippines, Vietnam, and other countries. So, you know, it's not as though China is just sitting back and building its economy and not doing anything to cause anxieties, fears, and concerns.
Okay, Mr. Pfeffer, China warned the U.S. against meddling in its internal affairs and threatened firm actions against U.S. interference in issues like Hong Kong and, of course, Taiwan. Considering the congestion of forces in, above, and below the Taiwan Straits and the South China Sea, a conflict could explode by accident or even by design. Is a serious escalation over Taiwan imminent, in your opinion?
Well, I think I would agree with Brian that there is really not an imminent chance of military conflict between the United States and China, that both sides are eager to avoid any kind of significant escalation. As I said, the Biden administration wants to focus on rebuilding the United U.S. economy. China, of course, is focused also on not just economic progress within China, recovering obviously from the COVID crisis, but also building its One Belt, One Road initiative throughout the world. But at the same time, there's always a chance of unexpected escalation. This has been a threat now for a couple of decades, really, expectation that some miscalculation in the Taiwan Strait or in the South China Sea will lead to an escalation. We've seen incidents in the past, whether it was the downing of a U.S. plane by the Chinese during the George W. Bush administration, or more recently, Chinese moves in Xinjiang province, Hong Kong, domestically within their own country that have that the United States has strenuously protested against. Any of these could escalate, move out of control, grow out of control. But I don't think it's imminent. As I said, there really aren't not a lot of actors, even in the region, that are eager to see any such crisis take place. There's Japan, South Korea, even the Philippines, Vietnam, whatever anger they might have over Chinese moves, they are not eager to have a full-fledged war.
All right, Mr. Downing, you addressed this question earlier. Allow me to rephrase it. Is the U.S. willing to risk a serious escalation with Beijing when it comes to Taiwan?
Well, the question sort of presupposes some sort of hostile action by China towards Taiwan. As I said, they're flying planes over, but Russia's flying planes over Alaska probably as we're taping, doing this interview. Taiwan is a very big island. It has a strong military. The place is well defended. the Chinese attacked, I don't know that China would win. Their navy would be highly vulnerable in the Taiwan Straits for several months as a ground campaign unwound. And they could take a beating from ship-killing missiles that Taiwan has, the United States, Japan, lots of people. The analogy I made in an article was the Battle of Okinawa during 1945, where an American fleet was outside of Okinawa, a pretty small island about 100 miles south of the Japanese mainland. And the United States, I don't have the numbers at hand, but I think the United States lost about 150 ships sunk or put out of action by the Japanese armed forces, mainly the famous kamikaze planes. If China did somehow take Taiwan or try to, I think the United States, the Quad that Mr. Pfeffer referred to, could cut off oil from the Persian Gulf very easily. Look at all the American military bases in the Persian Gulf. They could close it off in a matter of 24, 36 hours. There's nothing China could do there. If they send any ships to hostile action, they'd be sunk in a matter of hours. Furthermore, if China did do that, it's highly likely that South Korea and other countries would go nuclear. They are already nuclear, pretty much nuclear powers. They have the fissionable material. They have the warhead capacity. They have the missile systems. They're what's called a latent nuclear power. And I don't think China wants that. You know, something that could happen, there are a few islands owned by Taiwan that are maybe 5 or 6 miles, 10 kilometers off the Chinese coast. Kemoi Matsu, they're called the Tianmen Islands, I believe. Do a web search for those pictures. You'll see these islands with big fortifications and clearly visible in the background. You can see Chinese skyscrapers. So I think something we could see is for China to take those islands. They're utterly indefensible.
Mr. Pfeffer, let's look at this from another perspective. What is China's main priority in its relations with Washington?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, I think China has a number of priorities. The first, of course, is, as the spokesperson said, the United States should stop interfering in what China considers to be its sovereign territory, that China should, that China just wants to do whatever it wants to do within its own borders without having to deal with certainly the criticisms of other countries, but also other forms of interference. So I think that's number one, and China has pursued a non-interference policy for decades. When it comes to the economy, the Chinese would like to have, free rein in terms of their actions around the world. They don't want to encounter any kinds of sanctions or additional tariffs or any other barriers to investment when they're looking towards, for instance, extracting raw materials from other countries or setting up various types of infrastructure projects. So that's number two. I mean, they definitely want to be able to get along more or less with the United States economically. The overlap with U.S. Interests comes to a point with environmental issues. China has done a pretty good job of addressing climate change issues or reducing carbon emissions within its own borders, closing coal-fired plants, for instance. It hasn't done such a good job in terms of encouraging that through its One Belt, One Road initiatives, through its infrastructure development projects, in part because they've been exporting some of the same kind of dirty energy projects abroad that they've been winding down domestically. But here's a possibility for overlap with the United States, and that is during the Obama administration, Beijing and Washington worked together on developing clean energy technologies through the Clean Energy Research Consortium. And that's still ongoing. It kind of fell under the radar, fell off the radar during the Trump administration, but it's still ongoing. It's conceivable that China and the United States could find greater common ground on such kinds of clean energy cooperation, research and development. So that's a third kind of priority that we could see in U.S. China relations.
Yeah, we're running short of time. Allow me to get one last question in for Mr. Downing. Very briefly, if you may, Mr. Downing, what happens? We've already seen the Biden administration's approach to China. It's been very hostile and antagonizing. What happens if China takes a no-compromise approach towards the U.S.?
I'm going to have to ask you to spell that out, what that non-compromising position would be. I don't know whether they're going to cut off American products from being sold in China. Two can play that game. Are they going to stop investing in the United States? That would be a pretty serious blow. I think what China wants to do is become the dominant investing power in the world. Second, it wants to be the dominant market in the world. If you want to sell your products in China, well, we're going to have some sort of political comedy there. Third, I think China wants to control natural resources, iron, copper, specifically rare earths. And if they control those, again, they can moderate the behavior of their opposition, including the United States.
End it there. Allow me to thank my guests, Director of Foreign Policy and Focus at the Institute for Policy Studies, John Pfeffer, joining us from D.C. Also, thanks to National Security Analyst Brian Downing, joining us from Florida. Also, a special thanks to you for staying with us on this debate. It's good night for now.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
The Month of God. In the name of God, the compassionate, the merciful, Salam and welcome to the program. We are with you with another episode of the special series for Ramadan. Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny, said that the blessed month of Ramadan is the month of patience and steadfastness. Fasting has a lot of positive effects, one of which is the strengthening of patience and steadfastness. Human being usually faces problems and hardships in life. Fasting helps him to face these problems more patiently. Man's being is a source of a lot of tendencies, each of which are involved in his move toward perfection. But if these tendencies are not directed in the right course, they will cause many troubles. If man succeeds to administer these tendencies correctly, he will be able to move in the right path. Imam Sadiq, peace upon him, said, "Whenever a hard incident occurs for someone, he should fast. Because God says in Ayah 45 of Surah Baqarah, and take recourse to patience and prayer." Here, patience means fasting. The best element to strengthen patience is fasting, and the best element for remembrance of God is prayer. Anyone who seeks help from these two elements will surely overcome hardships, devilish inclinations, and the carnal desires. In continuation of discussing atonement for fasting, it should be said that if atonement is obligatory for someone, it is necessary to perform it immediately. But it should be neglected so that it is considered as depreciating God's command. Tonight is the first night that has been considered as the night of Qadr. Imam Sadiq, peace upon him, says, on the eve of the 19th of Ramadan, destinies are written. On the eve of the 21st, they are determined. And on the eve of the 23rd of the month, they are signed and finalized. For the eve of the 19th of the month of Ramadan, there are common rites like the eves of the 21st and 23rd of this month, such as the ritual washing of body, that is ghusl, night vigilance and recitation of Joshan Kabir supplication. Besides, it is also recommended to recite this zikr, or remembrance of God, 100 times. Astaghfirullah Rabbi wa atubu ilay, which means, I seek forgiveness from God and repent to Him. Real repentance is not the one that is just done verbally, but it should be done practically. If we have violated any right, we should compensate for it. If we have damaged any property of anybody, we must retaliate and provide him the same thing. Dear friends, it is recommended to say this phrase 100 times on the eve of the 19th of Ramadan. Allahumma al-an qatalata amir al-mu'minin, which means, O God, curse the murderers of the commander of the faithful. On this night, in 40 AH, the renegade Abdul Rahman ibn Muljam struck the head of Imam Ali, peace upon him, with a fatally poisonous sword at the mosque of Kufa. And this is another supplication which has been recommended to recite on this night. O God, set in what you decide and determine of the certain affair, and in what you specify of the wise affair on the night of Qadr, and of the determination that will not reverse or change, to write my name among the Hajj pilgrims, whose Hajj is accepted, whose effort is forgiven, whose sins are forgiven, and whose evil deeds are amended. And set in what you decide and determine to elongate my life and to amplify my sustenance. Then the faithful can plead to God for whatever they want at the end of this supplication. Dear listeners, as it was said in the previous episode, we are highly recommended to remember Imam Mahdi on this night, as he is the Imam of the age and God's vicegerent on planet Earth. It is emphasized in the hadith of the Imams to pray for Imam Mahdi on this night and beseech God to expedite his reappearance.
IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.